TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I hope you won't be too annoyed by the woodpecker that's outside my studio today.
Well, Chris, the only thing worse than a woodpecker is a two-headed woodpecker. And so I guess we're recording from Nepenthe today.
We are.
Which is weird because this house looks like it's been created by some hipster country weirdos. But it is good to know that I'm better at Riker than something. I'm not only good in bed, but I'm also good at pizza. So there you go.
Wow. That might fall under the category of TMI, Matthew.
Well, I thought that a little bit about their comments, but you know, they've been married for a long time, so I'll give it to them.
All right. Yeah. Well, okay. I'll save this for when we really get started, but it's related to what you just said right there. So everyone, we're going to be continuing our look today at Star Trek Picard Season 3 as it unfolds. This is Episode 8, Surrender. And Matthew, based on what you just said right there, there's something that Deanna says in that conversation that really made me do a little bit of a double take. After she tells Will that when they came pretending to be him, they were charming, and she gives him the line, good and bad, bad at pizza. But then after that, she says, I knew they were imposters the moment they arrived. And yet, apparently, she still slept with the Will changeling, even though she knew they were imposters. Did you catch that?
I don't think that that's what actually happened. I'm pretty sure that's a joke.
That's how I read it. Yeah, I think it's a joke. I hope it's a joke anyway.
No, I mean,
that she was making.
Yes, there, I think that the whole scene there between them was very interesting, that they started off in this kind of lighthearted manner, rekindling some of that charm and romance that they've had. But I think the thing that was great about this whole scene and getting to spend time with Riker and Troy together was to understand, we got a sense and an understanding of what had happened to Riker when Thad had died, but what had really brought on this separation between the two of them, I thought was really fascinating. And I think it also gave us an insight into what a struggle it must be for a Betazoid like Troy to live with a non-Betazoid. Mm-hmm. And the friction that absolutely caused for them, and it's what created a chasm because of the actions that Troy took against Riker's will.
Mm-hmm. But with good intentions.
Yes, exactly. And but I think what I love about this is that it relates so well to, I think, anytime that you love somebody and you see them going through pain or grief, the thing that you want to do is to help, to be able to try and take that away in some way. And the beauty of this is this whole conversation is not about either one really being angry at each other. It's really about confession and them being secure enough in who they are as a couple and themselves to be able to confess to one another, because she does say, I did this because I wanted to help you. I wanted to help you carry what you were going through, but I forgot the main rule of being a counselor. You can't rush grief. You cannot skip a step. And I think this is so wonderfully important for us to be able to remember. And I really appreciate this season, I think, bringing out a lot of great themes, but this is one of the biggest lessons of life. You cannot skip steps when moving through terrible, hurtful, painful things. You have to go through every step, because each step is important in the journey to making oneself whole. And by her trying to force Riker through these steps or skipping steps, she had hurt their relationship. And I really appreciate the fact that we get to have this conversation and we get to have this moment of healing for these two as they have this. I think, again, the beauty of this is it's such a mature conversation between two adults, right?
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any of that ridiculous and very tired, I think, blaming one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I was just really impressed by what we get here in the story for these
And it
two.
Was also compact, I felt, because there's a lot of stuff packed in this episode where we've got this with Will and Deanna, and then we've also got the Data lore stuff coming later in the episode on top of the big story that's going on. And heading into the final two episodes, which I imagine are going to be really big on the resolution of the plot line involving Jack, you need to resolve some of these things, like with Data and Lore and with the Rikers. And so this was the time to do it. But finding a way to balance all that within the story, I think, was important. And I think they got the timing pretty good here. Because like you say, it's a meaningful conversation. It's a mature conversation. It gives fans that resolution to this relationship problem that they're looking for, but doesn't spend too much time on it. And also, I felt like it does run parallel to the Jack story a little bit, because when Will asks Deanna, why are we still on Nepenthe when we both hate it? And she says, mm-hmm. because we have to be willing to go through that door
right,
to what's
exactly.
next. Which in abstract terms, I think that's an important thing for us to be willing to do in life, but it's
exactly.
also a difficult thing to do in the sense of what you were just talking about. And in a literal sense here, the parallel to the door that Jack is seeing also works. So there's that connection there.
So one last thing that I thought was really interesting, and I wanted to get your opinion on this because I've seen a lot of kind of chatter about it online.
Mm-hmm.
And it is about these two characters realizing that they hate Nepenthe.
Mm-hmm.
And her calling it this place that it looks like it was created by retro prairie hipsters. And mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of fans say that that was not so veiled criticism of season one. And I could see how that could be the case. But I also felt like it was so many times, I think in our lives, we do something for someone else. And because it's not something that we want to do or something that we enjoy, mm-hmm. we kind of suppress the way we feel about it. And then mm-hmm. there's that moment where things just kind of finally rise to the surface where we can't hold it in anymore. And we've got to say, no, I actually hate this thing. And then, of course, mm-hmm. the other person's like, I hate this too. I thought you loved it. And it's and so in many ways, this kind of reference to me what so much of relationships is like when we don't mm-hmm. actually have the conversations and aren't willing to be honest with one another the way mm-hmm. we should be. And we hide things about ourselves because we think it's for the betterment of the other person, where in reality, it would be better for us to just have the open and honest conversations in love so that they could have maybe moved forward much sooner than this if they had been willing to open up and have this conversation before this. And I didn't take it as mean-spirited as a lot of people did. I found it more of this very funny way of saying, I hate this, and I don't know why we're doing it. Why are we doing it? Let's not do that anymore. Let's do something else.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, when you're in a relationship, if you think that a situation is making the other person happy, even if you're not happy with it, you have a tendency to stick with it, right? Because you want your partner to be happy. So that makes sense. And I also think that when you settle into a situation and you settle into a routine, which they no doubt would have on a place like Nepenthe, where mm-hmm. there's not a lot going on, right? You get comfortable in that, even if you're not thrilled with it, but it's your routine. And it takes real effort to make a decision to break out of that and do something different, especially if two people need to agree on that. And maybe you don't want to talk to the other person about it because you think they're happy, right?
Right.
You don't want to disrupt their life in that way. Why do people think it's a criticism of season one? I don't understand
that. Yeah, I've heard people say that they felt like it was pointed at Michael Chabon and those kind of things. And so, I mean,
why?
I don't know. I think people take things a little too seriously. This seems so much more, especially in the tone that they're speaking. This is a moment when these two married people are finally breaking free of the shackles that they have put on their own relationship by not having mm-hmm. honest conversations with one another, whether it's their hurts, their frustrations, or just plain honesty about where their lives have been in the last few years. And so I think it actually is very refreshing to see. And I think it's actually really well done in the episode because, again, anybody who's been in a long-term relationship before and or marriage, this is exactly what happens, right? And mm-hmm. so I think these characters, it's been 20 years since we've seen them and they've been married for a long time now. And these are the type of things that end up having to happen at this point in a relationship, usually, especially if you want that relationship to last.
Yeah, exactly. And not only have they been married a long time, but they were involved with each other for another 10, 15 years or more before that. So these are two people who have had a romantic relationship of some sort for 35 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get that at all. I didn't even think of that as being a criticism of season one in any way whatsoever. That's odd. But the other thing that some people might find odd, you might find odd, Matthew, in that scene is when Worf rescues them and then he tells Deanna, "I have counted the days since I last saw you like waves in the ocean, constant and unending. I have thought of your empathic gifts often during my self-evaluation. The work that I've done on myself, the level of sensitivity that I have achieved has been in more ways than one." And then Riker will interrupts. Is this a rescue mission or a continuation of the torture? Now, I thought it was cute and I thought it was, the season is filled with little nods and homages to things from past Star Trek. And I felt like this was one of the cute ones of just acknowledging that there was that brief moment when Worf and Deanna had a relationship and it didn't go anywhere. But I didn't think it was anything more than that. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was like Worf pining over her or anything. I think it was Worf just being honest in his newfound contentment in himself.
I would say it might be the only place in the season so far where I felt like the writing was a little off, in all honesty. I felt like they maybe took it a little bit too far. This, because I think that there's a way for Worf to be able to say what he's saying without sounding like a Shakespearean sonnet, which I don't feel like, I don't know, I just, it didn't seem to really, everything else this season has felt like a good extension of who Worf was, mm-hmm. but who he is now. Mm-hmm. This one felt like a little bit of a bridge too far. And to say, like, I've been counting the days, it rubbed me the wrong way because of his relationship with Jadzia. And it was like, why would you be counting the days when you had a marriage of somebody that you absolutely was in love with? And so I'm not saying that there was any ill will or anything. These writers, I trust them. I think they've been doing a great job. But here is a place where, just in all honesty, I think a little bit of criticism is due. I don't think that it works the way that they wanted it to fully.
Well, I don't think it feels like something that they wanted to do, like I said, as an homage, like a cute homage to that brief period at the end of season 7. But they didn't really think about, does it fully fit with the Worf that we've been portraying all season? Because I do agree with you, it does feel a little bit off in that sense. So it feels like, yeah, it'll be fine to put this in here, make Will uncomfortable, and then move on.
I feel like it was done for that comedic effect, and sometimes I think one of the dangerous aspects of comedy is that you can do something and it works comedically, but it doesn't necessarily work for the totality of the story as a whole, especially with the connections that we have. So I think you're right about that. One of the things about this scene, though, in the sense of having Worf and Raffi come and rescue them, we knew that they had left before and had been on basically a fact-finding mission, and they come back here. And one of the things I thought was fantastic, too many shows feel like they have to explain every little single detail and treat us like we're idiots. That if you don't tell us something happened on screen, that, well, how did that happen? But it's like, I saw so many people complaining about the fact that Worf and Raffi had taken a Starfleet shuttle to go do reconnaissance mission and being like, well, that seems stupid. But now we realize they were smart enough to have put the cloaking device on their shuttle so they wouldn't be detected. And now they're bringing it back. And of course, by the end of this episode, we put it back on the Titan so that they can therefore travel to your day undetected. And so this is one of those places where I was like, thank you. Thank you for treating me as an audience member as not stupid that I can put two together and have it equal 4.
Yeah, that is a problem in Star Trek fandom a lot. There are a lot of people who, if it didn't happen on screen, it couldn't possibly have happened. And even with the passage of time, when you know these people had lives, but you expect them to be as if they never progressed from the last time you saw them, and then suddenly they're unfrozen. And they're supposed to act exactly the way they did before, the way that you remember them. Nothing has happened for them. Yeah, you have to be willing to accept that characters have lives and things happen and things progress. And, you know, the way I've always looked at Star Trek, even The Next Generation, we got 7 seasons of that show. We got a lot of episodes. What is it, 178? But you know, so much more stuff happened for those people during that time than what we saw. All we're doing is we're just dipping in from time to time and witnessing some events in their lives. So even within the context of the Next Generation series itself, you would need to accept that other things happen off screen.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, too, I think the beauty of this is that this whole little sequence with Troy and Riker and Worf here, there's a lot of fun little callbacks. My favorite callback was, you know, Riker talking about how, oh, Picard's, if I know Picard, he's deep in planning his escape, basically, which great. This, I feel like this part of the season, we're really referencing the Undiscovered Country, because this finale is really coming to that end, right? Where we're trying to figure out the final mystery so then we can go confront the bad guy. And so I loved that. And on top of that, we do learn that the changelings had dissected part of Picard's parietal lobe, which was apparently the part of his brain that was infected with the Eremotic syndrome. And so we download the Shrike's database so we can hopefully figure out what it is that they are wanting with this. So that's one more key that we're doing. But we know from last episode that that diagnosis may actually been an error. So this is one of those places where how Picard's body fits into all this, your guess is as good as mine. I still don't get it yet.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. I have various ideas of how things might fit together. But as far as the parietal lobe thing goes and the iremotic syndrome, Jean-Luc is diagnosed with iremotic syndrome in All Good Things, if I recall correctly, which is important because it happened on the timeline after he was assimilated by the Borg and became Locutus. So, if something was either implanted or there was some sort of residual something in his parietal lobe that was diagnosed incorrectly as iremotic syndrome, it could have been a remnant of his assimilation.
I mean, it could be. Absolutely. I guess my question would be, would not, as they free him from the Borg and they make the necessary purification of him at that point when mm-hmm. that happens, would they not have been able to detect something like that in his parietal lobe with the amount of technology that we have in Star Trek? I feel like it would be hard to hide mm-hmm. something in somebody's parietal lobe that you wouldn't realize was there. And the reason I say that is because just in this episode, right, we have Beverly talking about what's going on with Jack, and she cannot detect mm-hmm. anything strange going on in his brain in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. therefore, it feels like if there was something in Picard's brain that was possibly askew or wrong at that point, especially as he would have been under intense scrutiny after being part of the Borg and now being de-Borg, mm-hmm. it just feels like it would have been very hard to hide something like that. But I yeah. could be completely wrong.
Yeah, well, they're retconning. If that's what they're doing, of course, they're retconning the story. So it could, they could make it work
sure.
however they want.
Sure, that's absolutely
It doesn't
true.
Necessarily need to be an object. It could be yeah. something organic. It could be something that grew over time, and so it was not detectable at that mm-hmm. point in time. And then when mm-hmm. you get to All Good Things, it's detectable, but it's misdiagnosed as being iremotic syndrome.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know how that would work. I can't imagine what it would be inside the parietal lobe that would be doing this.
Exactly.
It could have been left there. But someone who's a very clever storyteller could spin a yarn that way. So it could be something like that. And so that, along with some other things, is leading me to believe that there is a Borg element to the resolution of the story, but it's not the kind of Borg story that we would expect. Mm-hmm. And so we can discuss that a little bit further.
I think it definitely could be. And so I've always left the door open. Again, I think I've said many times mm-hmm. on the show that I 100% see that as being a possibility. I just am hoping that we're not touching anything Borg just because I'm kind of Borged out. I'm kind of bored with the Borg, but 100%, I think you're right. And I think it's one of the things that they have done this season, and I think it's very clear, is that there is absolutely something going on with Picard and his brain and the importance. They keep bringing up iremotic syndrome over and over and over again. And so I feel like there truly does have to be something that, whether it's a misdiagnosis or any of those type of things, like there really is something going on here. Mm-hmm. And so I'll be very interested to see how that plays out in the story. And the best part about this story, I think, and we've said this many times, is I still don't quite understand how this all works together, which I like. And I think, as we mentioned last time, it does leave me to feeling like, okay, I really just want this story to land the starship well, because everything mm-hmm. has been set up, I think, so wonderfully that I want this to come to a conclusion and feel like, they got it. And so And we're still in that place where it's like, I don't know if that's going to happen yet. We don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, while we're talking about this, let's just go ahead and delve into theories of how they might land the Starship, as you say. And we've been talking for weeks and weeks now about the Pod Wraiths, which you and I are hoping is what it is, because we're Niners, and it would be an interesting way to go with the story, whereas the Borg would be an obvious way and an expected way to go with the story. But there's also this possibility that it's the Borg, and this episode led me in that direction a lot more, although there's also stuff this episode that still makes me feel it can be the Pod Wraiths. And then there's a third possibility from this episode, which I do not think is what's happening, because it wouldn't really make any sense to go here, but there's Armus from Skin of Evil. And I know a number of people have been talking about this as a possibility, and I think that it probably stems from some of the things that are said about loneliness and isolation. And then there's it could be a tiny clue, although I don't think this is why it's there, the holographic projection of Yar, who Data shows to Lore. That could be a tiny little clue there. But it just feels like too much of a stretch. Like, it's one of those things that you can pull things out of the episode and make them fit this idea, and it is tied to the Next Generation. But how would Armus have organized all of this? Why would Armus have such a vendetta against the Federation itself? And does it have any other connection to any of the characters, to the changelings, to the Dominion War, to anything else that is core to this story?
Right.
And it really doesn't. And so I think it's an interesting path to go down, but I don't think that that's what's happening.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right on that. I don't see this as being that either. I don't think that it does really make sense. I mean, if you really wanted to completely shock, I think, fandom, it absolutely could be. But I think that would be a true and an utter shock if you mm-hmm. went that far back. And if you pulled out, I think, a villain in Star Trek to which most fans would be like, huh? Because it's anybody who's a big TNG fan would get it immediately, right? But mm-hmm. I think that this is a pull that might be just a little bit too deep. And
yeah, I think so.
Would lack the resonance that you would want for the big bad in the final outing for the crew of the Enterprise E. The TNG crew. I just think that would be too much in that sense. So, yeah, I don't really see this being the villain, but I mean, it definitely could be. One of the things I think throughout this episode is that I definitely saw places where I think that this is pointing to a lot of the theories that we've talked about, but at the same time, it could not be. Like, I have to be honest and say, I do kind of have a feeling that Terry and the rest of the writers might actually have something in store here that I've never thought of. And that's fine with me, I think, as long as they land the plane.
Do you think they could possibly be combining our two theories, where there is a Pod Wraith and a Borg connection together somehow?
I mean, I think that anything is a possibility at this point. I guess it's probably just a good idea to talk about the Jack in the Box since we're like dancing around him. So we might as uh-huh. well just dig into that. But Vadic says that they want Jack for his gifts, which we did see and we kind of predicted a little bit last episode that he would try to use those gifts to retake the Enterprise. It didn't completely work, but he did try. She's aware of the voices that are in his head. She understands the isolation that he's been feeling. She talks about going from system to system, species to species, always feeling isolated. And now he's finally hearing these voices, and she knows that he's been seeing this red door. So she knows a lot about this, which is very interesting.
Okay,
and
so about the red door, this is something I wanted to mention to you. I was rewatching these particular parts of Surrender, and then I went back and watched some stuff from the previous episode as well. And what she knows about what's going on really made me start thinking and thinking about her connection to him. And then there are a few things. For one thing, when the fact that she knows about the red door means that she has likely had the same visions that Jack is having, or she has some involvement with those who are creating these visions in him, and she knows what he's being shown because she knows that there's a red door. And she even says, "Don't you want to know what's behind that red door?" And Plummer stresses the word red. It's like very specific that she knows what he is seeing. So how does she know what he is seeing? So then I roll back. When Jack comes on the bridge, she calls him baby boy. It sounds like a mother talking to a son, right? Oh, baby boy. And then even earlier than that, when she takes over the bridge, Vadic sits down in the captain's chair. She looks very uncomfortable, and she starts messing with her left hand, where we've seen her peel off, or whatever, the face that comes out. She's messing with her hand a little bit, and then she looks kind of disoriented or uncomfortable. And then she says, "I am Vadic." And she stresses the word am. The inflection is like, "Ah, I am Vadic." And so I'm wondering if the face that we're seeing, the face is whoever's controlling everything. I think the face has some very clear connection to Jack, almost in a motherly sense, because Jack has been somehow created, as we've discussed over the weeks. And I feel like the face had taken over Vadic at that point, where the Vadic that we've been watching all season faded away. And what we're seeing from that point forward is the face taking over in using Vadic's body, sort of in the way that we see Jack controlling other people as well. And this is one of the connections that I feel supports our Pa Wraith idea, because whatever's going on, the face seems to be able to possess someone. Jack obviously can possess people. And that is something that we've not seen the Borg do in the past. So anyway, that's what I noticed in like going back and rewatching little spots many times about the face and Vadic and Jack and this connection, and how Vadic seems to be aware of what Jack is seeing and encouraging him to open the red door.
Yeah, I think all the things that you mentioned make so much sense as to the idea that this is, again, Pa Wraith related, or in some ways something spiritually related. I mean, we also get Deanna talking about the fact that she sends darkness the moment she came on board. Not directly in Jack, but around him, ancient and weak, this voice that is not his own.
Yeah.
It's obviously clear. He says he's never been a changeling. He's never been in a change form. He doesn't. Again, too, Beverly would know what she's looking for now. So there's been nothing about him that's been physically scannable. There's something about him that is another dimension type of level as to what's going on. So that means it can't be changeling. I don't think it's Borg related. So it either has to be something like a Paw Wraith and or an Armus or something of that nature, to which is so foreign to everything that we know and is detectable through scientific means that we can't figure it out. And and I think you did a great job of just kind of pointing out a lot of the ways that this does seem to connect with that idea of like changelings, the idea of like the Paw Wraiths and those kind of things. Again, I am struck by in this though, that it's one of those things where I have this sense that we are just going to be, I think, surprised as to exactly what it is that, you know, Terry has up his sleeve.
Yeah.
And
no, I think you're right.
I think that's a good thing. I want that to be the case. Yeah. But I, you know, again, there's been so many places where, as we've been talking through this season, where we've kind of been right about some of the stuff. So it's like, I feel like there's stuff here that we're kind of right about, but that the actual fruition of the story is going to be all its own.
Yeah, I think so too. And that's wonderful because that's what we want in a story, right? That's why I increasingly think like it's not going to be just that the Paw Wraiths want to possess Jack and use him to destroy the Federation. It's not going to be just that the Borg have been incubating Jack for some bigger plan to destroy the Federation. It's going to be more complicated than that. And so, yeah, I think we're right about some elements and wrong about others. And definitely, we don't know how they all connect. You mentioned spiritual realm, and there's another possible clue that has been in the season, especially early in the season. When they go to the 10 Forward bar, there's a neon sign on the wall for Arcanus Lager. Now, it might just be an Easter egg because there was a sign for Arcanus Lager in the bar on Earth in The Search for Spock when Bones goes in trying to find a ship to take him to Genesis. So it might just be that. But the name Arcanus comes from Latin and it means secret. But it also often was used to refer to the mysteries of the physical and the spiritual worlds. And so I started wondering if that's just a tiny hint, because they could have put anything up there.
Oh, yeah.
And it probably is just the Easter egg to The Search for Spock. But just knowing what the word Arcanus means and looking at the story that we're seeing and knowing that we feel that there is a spiritual world connection, possibly Paw Wraiths to it. It felt like, I mean, they're quite clever with the story, so that could be a little clue.
Well, and so the thing that I like about that as an idea is that this is one of the ways in which I think paying homage to all of 24th century Trek would make sense. So even if it was not a Paw Wraith influence, right? The influence of the idea of spirituality and religion was much more important in Deep Space Nine and Voyager, of course. And so to then have that confront the characters of TNG, which were the arbiters of, no, it's just about science, I think would be really fascinating. And in many ways, that would be the final frontier for these characters, because they are not comfortable with the spiritual, I don't think. And so to me, that I would just find that so interesting. And so, yeah, the possibility here that that's the case to me is very exciting. And I think that that is going to be the case. Whatever shape it takes, I do think that that's what's going on. There has to be something that's going on here that has nothing to do with a scientific answer that Beverly could have figured out just by doing some technobabble. right?
Because she would have figured it out if there were.
Exactly. Right. And you don't, the thing is that you don't want to make any of the characters stupid, right? And if this was something that could be figured out just scientifically in any way, Beverly and the rest of the crew should be able to figure it out. Otherwise, they're dumb.
Because they did, time and again.
Yes.
In the TNG series.
Exactly. 100%. So, no, if there's anything that I am quite clear on with this season, is that there is just some sort of spiritual aspect to the story, which is driving these characters and driving the story, especially when it comes to Jack. And I love that. Again, I think that makes for, to me, probably the most interesting challenge for the characters of the Next Generation.
Now, one thing that I also noticed when I went back and I rewatched the first three episodes last night is that in 17 seconds, there's that moment where Jack gets knocked out by the changeling, and he wakes up and Seven is standing over him, and she says, or her mouth is moving anyway. I question whether it's actually her saying it, because it seems to be like a hallucination. Connect the branches. And we've still continued to be shown the branches, but we haven't focused on them as much in recent episodes as we did early on, where he would have these visions and the branches would come. And like, even that vision that he had of himself going onto the bridge and killing all the bridge officers, the branches came across her face, right?
Right.
The Hylian's face. And I feel a little bit like we've all forgotten about Connect the Branches at this point, as we're speculating on what might be going on. And so I was thinking about, what do branches mean? What can they represent? And if you think about like dream analysis and what branches could mean, there are a lot of ways you could interpret that. But one way of interpreting it could be spiritual nourishment, where you're trying to make spiritual and emotional connections through relationships with people and trying to build these connections. And then I'm thinking about some of the dialogue here, where Vadic tells Jack, "You've heard them, haven't you? The voices, what's that like? After years of solitude, silence, then finally so many voices. I can help you put the pieces together, the answers." And also before that, when Seven steps back out of the turbo lift and Vadic says, "How fitting it is for you to stay and witness this." Well, why would it be fitting for Seven in particular to stay? And so that's when I started thinking about Borg ideas, like the fact that when Seven was disconnected from the collective, she had to endure this silence where she no longer heard the voices in her head anymore.
Yeah.
And then I also was thinking about, we saw that elsewhere in Voyager 2, you know, where drones had been disconnected from the collective. And so what is it like to be part of this chorus of voices and then to have silence? And that started making me think about the idea of, what if the Pah Wraiths want to have some kind of connection, because they've been locked away in the fire caves and all, they want to have some kind of connection. And if somehow Jack has some Borg technology in him that can allow collective, or at least connections like this, to be created, and therefore they're after that as a way of escaping their own imprisonment. It's a stretch, but I just started like trying to connect pieces like this, because like we were saying a moment ago, I really feel like this is a more complicated puzzle that probably involves multiple things.
Yeah, I think, as you were saying that, one of the things I was thinking of is just how we had the conversation between Jack and 7 earlier in the season when he was talking about the ways in which how she had the family on Voyager and now she's looking for a new family. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a good possibility that her saying that the you coming to witness this, this is about Jack helping something connect to something, which is a part of, I think, the whole thematic element of this season, which is we've watched these Next Generation characters be disconnected from one another because of various mm-hmm. things that have happened in their lives as they've moved forward, and about how we as human beings need connection. In fact, the greatest human adventure is found in the relationships we have in one another, right? Because we are relational beings. And so it is in those relationships where the most life actually happens. You even think of, and we'll talk about it in just a minute, but you know, you even think about with In Concert with Data, all of the trinkets that he carries have emotional connection to interactions he's had with other people, right? And or his relationship with Spot, which is a relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think to me, like, it doesn't, with Seven, it doesn't necessarily just have to be a Borg thing, but there really is that connector in the sense that these are all people, and especially her, who truly wants to have family and relationship and to be known and to be loved. It's the greatest desire of all human beings, and we have to have both, right? And one of my favorite authors, Timothy Keller, says, to be loved but not known is comforting but superficial. To be known and not loved is our greatest fear. But to be fully known and truly loved is a lot like being loved by God. And he says, it's what we need more than anything. It liberates us from pretense, it humbles us out of our self-righteousness, and it fortifies us for any difficulty life can throw at us. And to me, that quote has kind of exemplified this season when it comes to these the idea of the relationships between these characters, because the season is also reminding us that these characters are better together than they are separately. They're the best versions of themselves together because mm-hmm. they bring the best out of one another because of their relationship. And so I'm sorry to just totally like monologued there. You well,
at least you're
monologuing.
Not a monologuing protoplasm.
It's true. I could probably get turned into one, but no, I 100% agree with you and see where you're coming from. And I think, you know, this is so interesting because in the end, Jack is terrified to open this door and what's behind it. And we end the episode, of course, with Troy saying, we'll go through it together. And thankfully, we're finally going to get the answers in the next episode. So I
maybe. Well, you never know. The next episode might end with, now, Jack, it's really time for you to find out what you are.
Yeah, if they do that, I'm going to be really, really mad. But I don't think they're going to do that. So
one other thing I wanted to mention about Jack is we've all, not just you and me, but I know many, many fans, have been taking the red eyes as a Pa-Wraith connection because it's happening exactly the same way that the Pa-Wraiths or people who were possessed by Pa-Wraiths looked in Deep Space Nine with their eyes. But as I kept going down this Borg path a little bit here, the Borg also have the red, the little thing on the side, right? The little red light that shines. What if an evolved Borg, through some kind of manipulation, whatever is going on, now the red is actually in the eyes?
Yeah, let's hope not, Chris. Let's
I hope
that's
not.
A bridge too far.
It could be, but it could, you know.
I'm very open. I could be completely wrong. The biggest thing here is I don't see us doing something that they did in the previous season.
Right.
And they did so emphatically.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think that more than anything, Terry Metalis wants this season to be able to stand on its own outside of mm-hmm. anything else. And therefore, it makes the most sense to me that what we're doing here is telling a story about
and so
something different.
You don't think that the face is actually the Borg Queen who somehow has incubated Jack as a new drone to finally get her revenge on being defeated over and over by Picard mm-hmm. and Janeway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If there's a god, then no, that's not the case. So,
well, there are prophets.
Yes. That's, I'm just
and
praying
there are
that we are not going down that road. So
yeah.
It feels like a road we've already been down, and I don't need to be down mm-hmm. that road again when it comes to mm-hmm. storytelling. So
one more thing related to Jack and being able to control people. I did want to mention listener Suzanne Bruins sent us a really nice email with a lot of theories, really well thought out theories. And there was one thing that she mentioned in here related to DS9 that I actually hadn't thought about. She said, you talk about Jack's telepathic abilities and visions, hallucinations, and now and how these relate to abilities of other species. It also reminded me a bit of the DS9 episode Things Past, where Solid Odo accidentally drags Dax, Garrick, and Sisko into a telepathic version of the Great Link. Even though his body is humanoid, his mind can still link with others in some way. What are your thoughts on this? Thinking about the idea that Jack could be some kind of human changeling hybrid.
I mean, it's anything is a possibility at this point. We have seen the ways in which the changelings themselves have been able to so mimic human beings that it's almost impossible until you really start dissecting them to get down to them not being who they are. They still can't seem to carry DNA mm-hmm. in the same way that we do. So, you know, he would have to be the ultra special version of that. So who knows? I mean, it really could be mm-hmm. anything. So, well, Chris, I just had one quick question for you. And it's just about this bit of tension that we see between Shaw and Seven.
Oh, yeah.
And we kind of get this clash of, Shaw really seems to be a rule follower, which makes sense for an engineer, right? You have to follow the mm-hmm. engineering rules,
yeah,
really,
sure.
for the most
yeah.
part. I mean, yes, you can think out of the box and get crazy, right? But there are these laws of engineering that have to be followed or things don't work. And whereas you got this other character in Seven who is like a Janeway, like a Kirk, where they think more with their gut. They think with their heart. And so I was interested to see their little kind of confrontation there on the bridge where she finally stands up for herself and says, my name is Seven of Nine. And mm-hmm. she chooses to stand with Jack, who I feel like she has become friends with. Mm-hmm. And she chooses the consequences of that action, right? Because she's choosing mm-hmm. to face the consequences of the fact that she did not blow the turbo lift. And then once we free the ship of Vadic and Shaw comes out, he allows Seven to take this one, which is to be able to blow up the Shrike. And it made mm-hmm. me wonder, are we seeing in those moments the equilibrium happening there a little bit with these two characters where they maybe finally understand one another because Seven has finally just stood up to him and said, this is my name. Call me by my name.
Yeah.
Say my name, say my name.
Yeah, I don't know for Shaw that would really move him. I'm curious to see what happens with Shaw, because Metalis has said that there is a redemption arc for Shaw, and I don't feel like I've seen it yet.
Right.
He's gone along with everybody because he kind of has to, but he has repeatedly fallen back into yes. the Shaw that we saw at the beginning of the season. And I think what might end up happening is that in the end, they're going to save the day. I would expect they will, because it would be odd for a Star Trek season or series to end with the complete destruction of Star Trek. So I imagine that they will save the day, and that will only happen because they didn't follow the rules and they did think outside the box and they took chances. And maybe when it's all said and done, Shaw will realize that the path that he was on is not a path to success, is not a path to greatness or solving problems in a critical moment. It's a path to surviving, maybe in most situations, but not in the one they found themselves in this season. And so he might come around right. at the end. So, you know, a lot of people have been wanting the Star Trek Legacy spinoff series with the Titan and with Shaw and Seven.
As they should.
Which I think would be, yeah, I think it'd be really interesting. But some people have questioned, like, how would that work given the animosity between the captain and the first officer? How would Seven just forgive the way that she's been treated by Shaw? And I think that the way that might work is what I just described, is that in the end, Shaw will come around, because Seven is not going to change.
Right.
And she shouldn't change. I think Seven is a teacher to Shaw, and he will realize that in the end.
Yeah.
Seven's character makes a lot of sense, because Janeway was like a mother to Seven. And so in many ways, Seven, she sees things very much in the way that Janeway did. If Janeway had acted like Shaw, she would have never gotten her crew back. They would have been stranded in the Delta Quadrant. They probably would have died. It was only by being willing to bend the rules, adapt to the situation, break the rules completely when necessary, that they were able to survive.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's the ship that Seven lived on. That's the ship where she found herself after she was separated from the collective. And so it makes perfect sense that that's how she would be, because those Janeway was her role model, as were other crew members of Voyager.
Right.
Plus, I think it's just in her DNA, too. It just seems like who she is. I think if Annika Hansen had grown up and never become a Borg, she would have the strong personality as well. That's speculation, but it feels like that's naturally who she is.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that.
I look at my own daughter, who's that kind of very strong, ever since she was little, that very strong-willed, strong personality, can take care of herself kind of personality. So, yeah, I think that's probably what I see there. I don't think her standing up to him and saying, "My name is Seven of Nine," is going to make him go, "Oh, yeah, you're right. I really shouldn't treat you like that."
I guess it wasn't just the idea of, like, yeah, her standing up and saying, "This is my name," but I felt like he challenged her and living up to the consequences of her actions. And I felt like her being willing to stand with Jack and face the consequences of her actions with him, regardless of what came, in the sense of, he tells her, you know, "You're not going to make a difference here, right? This is not going to help." And that she is choosing to say, regardless of whether or not this helps, I'm not leaving somebody behind, basically. I'm standing with my crew and with my friend. And in that, I think, I'm wondering if that's the thing that helped him kind of see, okay, this is who this person is, and I respect them for that in a way that I haven't respected them before. So, and whether or not it's the full resolution of that story, it seems like it was a part of a stepping stone to them finding a better equilibrium, because again, you know, Seven shows herself to be, I think, a character much in the vein of somebody like a Kirk or a Janeway who loves their crew and thinks of them as family. Even a Sisko, honestly, right? Picard was the only captain, I think, who felt like so removed from their crew. Even Archer. And my wife and I are watching through Enterprise. We're in the second season. We're behind where we are in Warp 5 right now, so we're in season 2. And it's her first time. But Archer's very much like that as well. So I think that's just a fascinating thing. And it's a storyline that I'm very interested to see play out, because Shaw has become, I think, a more nuanced character than he was at the beginning. And so I'm hoping that that will continue.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it will. And I think Shaw will change by the end. It's just a slow process for him. Well, one other big thing we need to talk about before we get to the end here is Data and Lore and the new improved Data that can use contractions. And what did you think about how they resolved this whole idea of the new android body that has both Data and Lore inside?
This was interesting because I think this is an area which I was not surprised whatsoever. Everything played out the way that I thought it would, because it's the only thing that made sense. And I think it made narrative sense and it made thematic sense. And I just love the way that Data was able to make it happen, in the sense that he willingly gave up who he was to his brother. And by his brother taking that into himself, he became Data, because he was giving away pieces of who he was. So he wasn't actually dying. He was just becoming Lore, and they were becoming one. And I thought it was great. I mean, what was interesting too is the way in which this allows the character of the Data that we saw in season one to have existed and had their desires come to fruition. This Data is obviously a backup of Data, so not completely the entire Data that we knew, but close enough. And in many ways, Data has finally become a real boy. He is fully human as you can get without actually being human. And part of that is that, as I was mentioning last week, the enemy within, Lore and Data are now a part of one another, as well as B4, Soong, a little bit of Lol there. And so he really has the full gambit of what it means to be human. A lot of people have made comments like, well, Data had humor before, and it's not like Data didn't feel before. He had the emotion chip, right? But there was still a part of Data that was missing. And so now Data, when he feels, when Geordi asks, how do you feel? And he says, I feel. He feels with the entire range of what it means to be human. The good, the bad, and the ugly, right? Which is what it means to be human. And so I thought this resolution
was evolution, my dear Watson.
Exactly. And I thought it was fantastic. So did it work for you?
Yeah, I think so. I'm thinking as you're talking, I'm just thinking about the evolution of Data. And I'm also thinking about artificial intelligence now, because it's such a hot topic these days. And so forth. I'm thinking about what it means to be human and what was lacking in Data and what was lacking in Lore. And of course, there's the failed B4 experiment, but what Soong was trying to do from the beginning. So he creates Lore, who the colonists felt was too human and kind of scared them. And so Lore is deactivated, or at least that's the story that we get from Lore. And then Data is created, but Data doesn't have the emotions that Lore had, which makes him easier for the colonists to accept, but makes him less human. And so Data, we watch Data go on this journey, to try to become human. And then when we finally get to the films, we have the idea of the emotion chip. But what does it mean to be a person? What does it mean to be human? And I think what we get here plays in well with what we're seeing in all of our other human or alien, anyway, biological characters in this season. Of, I think last week you said there's so many people who are broken or things are broken and we're bringing them back together. And we're seeing how pieces fit together and how they complete one another. We even see that here with Will and Deanna as the Rikers are talking, how they have kind of fractured and then they're coming
right
back together to create this whole. And if you look at Data, the things that he says about trinkets are my memories, I thought was important, because while Lore sees himself as superior because he has emotions and he can feel, he doesn't actually understand the value of
right
interactions yeah and memories. And
he doesn't
Data,
understand the value of connection, like we always doing my right soliloquy on earlier. He doesn't get that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then Data, who at the later stages in the Next Generation films is able to have emotions because of the emotion chip. What has happened is there's a chip that inserts some other algorithms into exactly his programming that allows him to simulate mm-hmm the experience right of emotions, I would say. But I don't think he still has them in the same way that Lore has
exactly
them. And because Lore has those emotions, I think he can be dismissive of someone's memories and experiences. And he can see things like the deck of playing cards or the Sherlock mm-hmm Holmes cap yes and pipe or Spot or even the hologram of Yar as being trinkets and being trivial because he doesn't understand what they mean to someone else. Whereas we all as humans have objects that we keep around that if someone else looks at it, it looks like nothing. What is that? Why do you have that? But for us, it's very important because it's connected mm-hmm to some yeah person or some event in our life, something like that.
Yeah.
And Data says, my memories define me. I am who I am because they exist. And this actually echoes what Picard tells Laris at the very beginning of the season, in the first like 6 minutes mm-hmm of the season, when he tells her that these objects are my memories.
Yes.
And so we've connected Picard and Data in that way here within the season. But yeah, I thought the way that they played this, the two sides that, like you said, the enemy within can't fully function separately. But when right you bring them together, you create one person, one being, whether they're biological or synthetic, that becomes a whole and can really experience and understand everything. So I think that, yeah, it worked.
Yeah, I thought so too. And it, I think what it does is now we're on Data version 3.0. Mm-hmm. I think it really gives us, if you're going to bring Data back, this is the way in which it needs to happen. And I think it was well done. It was fun. And I think you could feel it, right? Like there was an emotion to it, to have that character back, what he means to everybody around him. So no, I could not agree with you more. I did have to ask you, Chris, I guess this was a good day to die for Vadic because she's decompressed off the bridge. Mm-hmm. And what did you think about the fact that her enhanced nature as a changeling doesn't allow her to survive outside of in space like we've seen before? And of course, she's killed and then the Shrike is destroyed, leaving just behind the mystery. Okay, who's behind this entire mystery now?
Yeah. Well, yeah, if I want to read something into it, I guess it's the warning that as we try to play with our biology and improve ourselves something can go wrong.
Yeah, that's right? A good point.
Changelings are, although she's not the one who made those modifications to herself, right? It was Section 31 who modified changelings to try to create these super spy agents. But right. The result is, whereas a normal changeling would have been able to survive in space, she cannot. So in her path for... It's hard to say her path, though, because, you know, she didn't choose this path right. for herself.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Yep.
As for it being the end of Vadic, yeah, I had been having the thought of, oh, great, now Vadic's gone and we didn't get the answers. But what I was explaining to you earlier about my theory that the Vadic that we had been watching had already gone at the beginning of this episode, and the face had possessed Vadic. The face is the one with the answers, and I think the face still exists because I think the face is possessing Vadic's body from afar. And so even though the physical body of Vadic is gone, and that changeling is gone, what was controlling Vadic is still out there and is on the other side of the red door, and we're going to find out. Yeah.
I mean, it was a great moment, though, when she's like, "Fracking solids."
Yeah.
And I thought that was wonderful. It was well-earned moment there for that character and her death, and then getting to see the strike destroyed. I think all of that really worked, and I loved it. I thought it's... What it does is it frees us up now to truly be able to then mm-hmm. focus on the enemy that has been there the whole time that we haven't been able to figure out who it is yet. And that's exciting to be mm-hmm. at that point of the season. You know, as you mentioned earlier, we're getting rid of excess story now so we can focus on the end, and that it can happen without us feeling like, oh, well we didn't really touch on... So I love that,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, part of this season, right before we get to the ratings first. The beauty is that we finally get the entire crew come together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the same room. And to me, this just feels like this is the way you do a love letter and a swan song to these characters of this magnitude. And in all honesty, yes, I'm throwing shade at you, Star Wars, because this is... everything that fans would have wanted from the sequel trilogy but never got, because our three big main characters never actually stay in the same room together. And so this is what people want to see when they come back to characters like this. And I think what was great about this season is that it feels earned to finally have these characters sit back in the same room together and come together. And that's something that doesn't happen very often when you get back into a series like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great to see them all together. It feels a little bit odd for them to all be together aboard a different ship that's under a different command. But yeah, it was a great moment to see. So, heading into final thoughts then, and ratings, anything else you want to share?
I mean, it's hard because as we're recording this, I'm just so ready to get to episode 9 so we can get the answers. And I do find myself a little bit frustrated because they're going to be doing screenings of the final 2 episodes together in IMAX screens at some select cities across the country. And a couple weeks early on a Wednesday, and I will unfortunately not get to go because the only one close enough to me is 3 hours away, and the fact that I won't be able to...
And like the changelings, you don't use transporters, so that's not an option.
I do not. So, but in all, this is a good episode, and I think the beauty of this is that it did give us some of those moments to just kind of sit back and like... take a breath for a second before we hit the 2-part finale, which in all honesty, I wish episode 10 was actually going to be 2 hours because I feel like the season could actually stretch to that point. But I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 red doors because at this point, I'm just excited to walk through that red door and see what is there so we can finally get these answers. This season has had us primed on the edge of our seat the whole time to figure out what's going on, and now we're there, and I can't wait to get there. And I've said it before, but I'll say it again. This season has also really connected me back to Star Trek in a way that I didn't know was going to happen. Even as much as I loved Strange New Worlds, there's something special about being reconnected with the Star Trek that I loved and basically grew up with, right? And to have that back and feel like this is doing that justice is fantastic.
Yeah, I think they did a really great job of wrapping up the character stories, as we've discussed, to get a set for that big ending here. And you mentioned the red door there in your final thoughts. And for me, that's just the last thing I'll mention as my final thoughts, is I'm just really looking forward to finally going through that door. And I'm especially looking forward to getting on Twitter and seeing everyone's reactions to the fact that when the door opens, we're actually going to step through into Sigourney Weaver's refrigerator and find out that Zool is the one who wants Jack.
Oh, that's what it was. That's what I thought. We were going to step into the red door and just see a candle there and realize that this is Beverly's grandmother's candle.
Jack is the love child of the ghost.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, which is just as, if not more terrifying than Zool. So,
yeah. Yeah. But seriously, I'm curious to see what's on the other side of the door. I think it has to have a spiritual element because it is like a metaphysical thing here to step through this door. And we see it's a red door, and we see through the keyhole that there's red something on the other side. Looks like it could be fire. We've seen Jack's visions where he sees what appears to be a city being destroyed. And even in this episode, I think we see that again, where they're kind of flickering back and forth what might be behind the door. So I'm just wondering what that realm is. Could it be the fire caves? Could it be something else? I'm not sure, but I think it's going to be very interesting to see. I do think that the face is going to play a role because, again, the way that I believe it was the face talking through the body of Vatic in this episode, it really sounded like a mother talking to Jack. Well, and so
the voice that he hears is Beverly's voice much of the time. So,
Yep. And let's not forget that Beverly, especially through much of the TNG, had very red hair. So we've got that red element as well. But yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating to see. And so I'm going to give this episode 8 Nepenthean Red-Winged Banshees. All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on surrender. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. So it is a closed group. And if you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post for this episode on the timeline. You can share your comments with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. We've had great chatter about the last few episodes in particular, so we really invite you to come join into that discussion. And if you are joining for the first time and need to find it, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If not, just type the Babel Conference, and you'll find it there. You can also send us email if you'd like to do that. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and your message will dance its way right over to Matthew and me. And of course, you can find us everywhere on social media. Our username is trekfm. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could really use your help. To find out how to get involved, how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can become an associate producer. You can get involved in other ways. We could really use your assistance, though it does take a great deal of money to produce and distribute these podcasts. And we would not be here without your help. So thank you so much to everyone who is supporting us right now. And lastly, if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not designing houses with a cabal of retro prairie hipsters, where can people find you?
Well, it sounds like a house out of hell, Chris, but you can find me. I'm just kidding. It actually sounds like something I would love, but you can find me.
A house out of the fire caves.
Right. Just as long as it is not the fire caves. You can find me all over social media under the name Mount Rushing 02. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero are the best places to catch up with me. Of course, I am here on the network. We've got a whole other side of the network devoted to everything outside of Star Trek called the 602 Club, and we definitely hope you'll join us over there. It's an absolute blast getting to talk about all of those fandoms we love outside of the Star Trek universe. You can also find me with Chris. We're doing The Orb, our 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Warp 5, our 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise, Saddle Up, about Strange New Worlds, and hey, that's coming back this summer, so we're so excited to be diving back into that series, and Literary Treks, about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Over on the Nerd Party Network, you can find me doing two shows. One is completed. It's called Owlpost with Dre Kaufman. Talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And last but not least, you can also find me doing Aggressive Negotiations with the great John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week. Now, Chris, when you're not worried about getting excommunicated from a starship via the view screen, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'll tell you, that has got me nervous. Now, every time when I'm driving my car, I'm worried that my front windshield is just going to open up and we fly right out of it. And it's going to close back behind me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, when I'm not worrying about that, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all those shows with you, as you mentioned. You can also find me with Larry Nemechek. We do the Ready Room from time to time, and also I'm in many episodes in the back catalog across lots of shows. And if you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek or Japan or music or football or whatever, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter's where I'm most active, but you can also find me on Mastodon, on the Trekkies.social instance, and all around in social media. And I look forward to chatting with you there. Well, Matthew, I can't believe that we have finally reached the start of the end, the big finale. So I'm looking forward to next week when we should finally hear from the voices.
Well, Chris, I can't wait till that happens. Frackin' solids.